Good morning, everybody. It's lovely to be here live and in person instead of watching from the back of the room on our screen in Brazil. For those of you who don't know us, I'm Jen. This is Phil. And we are missionaries in Brazil, but we are originally from the Cambridge Vineyard and still part of, yeah, still very much part of the Cambridge Vineyard. And happy to be here. And, you know, we walked in and Tab said, hey, are you busy? Want to host? And here we are. So bear with us because never done this before. But it's all going to be fine. Do you want to do the next part?
No, I haven't read the next part. You got it.
Okay.
I'm just looking at it.
Anyway, welcome, everybody. We're super excited to be here. We have Morella sharing today, which is awesome. We just had the pleasure of having Morella and Shayna in Brazil with us, training our team to be trauma aware, and it was life-changing. So I'm sure the message she's going to bring today is going to be amazing. And go.
So it is Pentecost Sunday, and we're probably not going to have a teaching that's what you would expect on Pentecost Sunday, but I'm going to encourage you guys, like the disciples that were in the upper room, to just be open to whatever God has for us. And you know, I think God has a sense of humor. Last week, Scott was talking about how he grew up kind of over here in this conservative tradition, and they did not want to be like those Pentecostals over there. And you know how I grew up? I was one of those. So I think it's God has a sense of humor. Last week you had Scott, this week you have me. All right, at the end of last year, had a couple of the transition team people come and say, you know, we're in this time of change and we're wondering if you can speak on change and how we manage change as a church. I said, sure, what do you have in mind? They said, we were hoping you had some idea. So here I am. Jason's chuckling over there. He was one of them. So over the next 3 months, I'm going to be teaching once a month, just addressing some things that may or may not be happening for you as we kind of move through this transition period. I read a quote this week. I don't even know who wrote it, but it said, the hardest changes to adjust to are the ones that are unexpected and out of our control. Yep, that sounds about right. I don't know. Is there anyone here that actually loves change? Like, yes, bring it on. Because that's not how it is in our family. Not the way the Smiths roll, but we are in this period of change, this time where Scott is retiring. And I don't know about you, but, you know, my expectation was as he moved out, we would have somebody new moving in. That's the way it works, right? Except that we had a little snag. We had some candidates that we liked and we extended an offer and they politely declined. And so here we are as a church, kind of in limbo, wondering, where do we go now? Luckily, we have Tab. Tab's going to step in. She's going to walk us through this transition period. But even the transition team said, hey, we're kind of feeling like God said, don't keep looking just yet. Just put a pin in that. But that kind of leaves us waiting, wondering. And for some people, that's not a very comfortable place to be. This place of the unknown, this place where we're not sure what's going on here, and it might make us a little nervous. It might make us a little anxious. It might make us a little angry. Because what we might be feeling, we might have something stirring in us. Something may be triggering a deep core belief that we have inside of us. What are core beliefs? Core beliefs are ideas, deeply held beliefs about ourselves and the world. We generally acquire our core beliefs very early in life. As we start to experience the world, we start to build a framework of what the world is like. How safe, how unsafe, what we can rely on, what we don't rely on, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. These are the core beliefs that are so ingrained in us that we might not even realize that we have these core beliefs. And for some of us, our early experience might be abandonment, uncertainty, neglect. Or maybe that wasn't even our experience, but we're still feeling a little unsure about what's going on. And maybe somewhere along the line in our life, we learned that we don't rely on other people because nobody sticks around. Nobody's there when we need them. And so we learn this deep independence because it's too risky to rely on other people. And this time of limbo might be a very scary time for us. Or maybe not. Maybe you're okay. Maybe you're like, yep, we're cool. I'm flexible. We can do this. No problem. So if that's you, please don't check out. Because as we talk about this idea of abandonment, if you're not feeling it now, if you've lived long enough, you've probably felt it somewhere along the line. And if you haven't felt it yet, you probably will, because this is part of our human experience as we struggle through life. So we're losing a pastor. Well, we're not losing a pastor. He's just moving on into the next stage of life. And maybe you're thinking, yeah, this is normal. And it is. Retirement is a great thing. I hope we all get there. And I hope we all get to enjoy it. But even still, even if our head says, yep, I know this was, we knew this was going to happen. 2 years ago, we started planning for this, right? This is what happens in life. And our brain might say, yep, I get it. But something inside might be saying, oh, this is not comfortable. And I'm not sure what's going on. So we're going to talk a little bit about change. We're going to talk a little bit about this feeling of abandonment and what do we do when we wonder what God is doing and where is he? There are a lot of examples in the Bible of people who were in the position where they're saying, God, where are you? I don't see you. I don't feel you. You know, that we sang the Waymaker, even when I don't see it, you're working. Even when I don't feel it, you're working. That's great to sing when we're not, you know, in it. When we're in it, it can feel a little bit bleak. Today, we're going to look at David. And I love David because not only do we get his story in 1 and 2 Samuel, but he gave us the Psalms. And the Psalms are a deeper, more intimate look into his feelings, into his struggles, into his joys. So we're just going to take a look at his life. We're going to look at his life from the time that he met Samuel to the time that Saul dies. So right before David becomes king. We're going to take a 10,000-foot view of his life. You can read all about him in 1 and 2 Samuel. Okay, so David is the youngest of 8 sons. His dad is Jesse. And the role that David performs in his family is that of the shepherd. So he's kind of like the lowest rung on the ladder. So he has to go take care of the livestock, which is a really important job because livestock was wealth and life at that time, but it's not a very prestigious job. So imagine he's out in his fields one day. Maybe he's like playing his harp or his lyre. He's just kind of hanging with the livestock, and someone comes running to him and says, David, your dad wants you. If any of you parents have gotten a phone call from the school in the middle of the day, probably David had that feeling too, right? So our secretary, when Eli was in Preston Public School, we knew each other, and she'd call me and she'd say, hi, Morella, it's Corey from Preston Public School. Eli is all right. Don't worry. That even before I had got to say hello, she was saying, he's fine, don't worry, because we know that if we get a call in the middle of the day from the school, something is probably not right. But she would always tell me, and then she'd go on and ask her questions. But that, I feel like David must have been like, what? So he runs home. He's like, Dad, what's going on? And there's Samuel. Samuel, who was a prophet and one of the judges at that time in Israel, because the way that they're, what's the word, government, ruling, whatever you want to call it, was judges. They didn't have a king, but they had been asking for a king for a long time. They were like, give us a king who's going to take us into battle, who's going to, you know, let us win, give us victory. So God said, all right, and he gave them Saul. And Saul was okay for a little while, then he went off the rails. And God said, yep, not working for me anymore. I am taking back my blessing, and we're getting you a new king. But Saul was still king, and he did not realize what was going on, maybe. So anyway, David comes in, and there's Samuel. And Samuel had come to Jesse's home, knowing that he was looking for the king. Jesse paraded his first 7 sons, all tall, handsome, strong. And everyone, Samuel was like, no. And he finally said, do you have any other sons? And Jesse was like, yeah, I'm a little guy, but he's a shepherd. So Samuel says, bring him in. So here comes David. And I don't know, we don't get the privilege of the conversation that went on or how this happened, but it tells us that Samuel anointed David with oil in front of his brothers. Can you imagine dinner that night? Everyone's like, yeah. What just happened here? You know, I don't know if Samuel told him that night, if that blessing included, you're going to be king. We don't get insight into that. But these 7 older sons who probably would have expected to kind of have the best life experience because they were older. Well, now they've got this, their baby brother just got anointed by the prophet. I imagine dinner was quiet that night. Maybe some side eye going on because you don't know what's going on. And the next morning, imagine the next morning. So you've been anointed with oil, you've been blessed, and you get up the next morning and you're like, what do you do with that blessing? So it goes on to say in 1 Samuel 17:15. So David is still doing the shepherding thing. And in the meantime, Saul is losing his mind. Right? Literally, he's being tormented. And the only thing that seems to bring him some kind of peace is music, which is empirically proven, by the way. Music does help with mental health. Just a little plug in there. So he says, I need someone to play me a harp. And one of his servants says, well, I know this kid, Jesse's son, is supposed to be really good on the harp. So Saul says, bring him in. So he comes in and he plays, and Saul says, I like this kid. He's helping to soothe my soul. So now, along with being a shepherd, David is also part of King Saul's mental health support team. So he's coming in to play the harp when necessary, going back to take care of the animals. He's going back and forth. And during this time, the Philistines come, and they come to the battle line, and they start taunting the Israelites. They have got this huge dude named Goliath, 9 feet tall, their best warrior. And they start parading Goliath out, and he starts talking trash. Like, where's your best soldier? Bring him on. Let's have a fight. And he does this day in and day out, but nobody wants to fight this guy. Can you imagine his reach? Like, he's 9 feet tall. You couldn't even get close to him, and he'd have you, like, before he even got close enough to give him a little slash. So nobody wants to touch it. And at this time, Jesse says to David, hey, go grab some food and take it to your brothers. His 3 of his oldest brothers were on the front line with Saul. So David gathers his food, goes out to the front line with his brothers and gives them their food. And sure enough, Goliath comes out at that time and he starts taunting them. Where's your warrior? Come on, let's fight. Let's do this thing. And David starts asking, like, what does the king say will be done for the man that defeats Goliath? So what's the king promise? And we get a little glimpse maybe into the atmosphere of Jesse's home when his oldest brother says in verse 28, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Wow, that's some vitriol there. You can see that his brother does not have a very high opinion of him and is really trying to kind of cut him down to size, right? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? Like, you don't even have a big job, kid, and you walked away. What's going on? I know how conceited you are, how wicked your heart is. Wow, that's pretty savage. And so I imagine that his seven brothers weren't really happy about his blessing that he received and were trying to kind of just keep him in his place. So we go on in the story and David's like, whatever. And he says, I'll go fight him. And Saul says, okay, well, come on, you can try my armor. David tries it on. He's like, no, this is not going to work. When I am out there with my livestock, I fight bears and lions. I'm just going the way that I always go, just me and my sling. So he takes five rocks from the river and he heads out to face Goliath. And Goliath is like, are you kidding me? You bringing this little boy to fight me? And what does David do? Grabs his sling, throws his rock, hits Goliath in the forehead and knocks him out. Everyone's like, what just happened here? And while they're all in a state of shock, David runs over, he grabs Goliath's sword, he kills Goliath and decapitates him. And everyone, of course, in the Israelites were cheering, maybe not his brothers so much, but, you know, everyone else. And Saul is like, okay, this kid, I'm impressed with this kid. He says, I'm keeping you. You're not going back to your dad. And so David stays with Saul and Saul puts him in the army. And it says that in chapter 18, verse 5, whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank position in the army. So things are looking good for David, right? Whatever that blessing was that Samuel poured over him, he's like, okay, this is coming to being. Wrong. Because they're as they're heading back home after they've won a few more battles and all that, and the ladies come out and they start singing. And they start singing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000. Uh-oh, sounds a little bit like David is getting a little more praise than Saul. But this was kind of a poetic sort of thing that they did back there where they would, it was called a couplet, and they would take, you know, numbers, thousands and tens of thousands, and they would kind of like juxtapose them or put them together. This was just what they did. And so nobody would have really interpreted that as extra praise for David. It was just kind of the way the lady sang. But Saul got really angry. And it says in verse 8, that Saul was very angry and this refrain galled him. And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. He kept him close, but he was looking for ways that he could get rid of David. So he thought, I'm going to try to marry him off to one of my daughters. And then, you know, before he can marry my daughter, he's got to go do a bunch of battles and maybe he'll die in one of those battles. But the first offer of marriage, David says, no, who am I to be a son of the king? No thanks. Then Saul tries again because Michal, one of his daughters, loved David. And so David says, okay, I will marry her. And Saul says, okay, but before you do, you got to go out and you got to get me like 100 body parts from the Philistines. David says, no problem. And comes back, he's got 200. So he's done even better. So imagine Saul, right? Just kind of hoping that he wouldn't come back, but here he is. And Saul just gets more and more discontented. And eventually, at one point, he throws his spear at David. He's going to try to kill him. This is not even a secret anymore. So David has to go into hiding. And he spends years running around the desert. He's probably dirty and hungry. He's always looking over his shoulder. And even when he has the chance to kill Saul and he cuts off the corner of his robe, he doesn't kill him. And then he comes to him and he says, look, I could have killed you, but I didn't. Saul says, okay, But then in a short time, he's back at him again. So David has to leave. And David is so perplexed that he says to Jonathan, who is his dear friend, as Anne of Green Gables would say, his bosom friend, and son of Saul, he says, "What have I done? What's my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life?" By all appearances, David did not do anything wrong. He was doing everything right. He was winning the battles for Saul. He was playing the harp for Saul. It must have been really kind of disheartening for David. And maybe he's thinking, this is not the way I thought things were going to play out after that blessing. And he's running around the desert, and it says he loses everything. He loses his wife, Michal, because she helps him escape. And then it says later on that Saul married her off to someone else because David's out and about running around trying to keep alive. He lost his good friend, Jonathan. You know, he lost his men. And it's funny, in chapter 22, verse 1 and 2, he gathers this other group of men, but it says they were all those who were in distress or in debt or discontented. So can you imagine 400 guys who are in debt, distressed or discontented? That does not sound like a very functional group. But David's got to whip them into shape. And what does he do? He carries on. He carries on fighting the Philistines and having these battles and winning. So eventually David is like, I can't do this running anymore. I am just going to go settle in the land of the Philistines. So he is going to settle in the land of his enemies because he knows that if he lives there, Saul is going to leave him alone. And sure enough, he lives there. And Saul does leave him alone for a little while. And he doesn't come back until Saul is dead. So imagine what it was like for David. I'm not a biblical scholar. I do not know how many years he was running around trying to save his own life. But David's written a lot of Psalms, right? And we often think of, oh, some of them are so beautiful. Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. Isn't that lovely? That is lovely. I don't think that's the one he wrote when he was in the desert. I think it was probably these ones, Psalm 10. Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Psalm 13. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. Psalm 55, listen to my prayer, O God. Do not ignore my plea. Hear me and answer me. My thoughts trouble me and I'm distraught. Psalm 6, hear my cry, O Lord. Listen to my prayer. From the ends of the earth, I call to you. I call as my heart grows faint. Do any of those feel familiar? Ever been at a place in your life where you have thought, God, where are you? Maybe there were promises and prophecies. And even if they weren't direct, we've got this book of promises and prophecies. And yet sometimes God feels so far off. The disciples must have felt the very same way in the upper room. Some of them been with Jesus for 3 years. Jesus had made promises. I am the Messiah. I've come to save you. And now he's gone? Can you imagine what that must have been like? In John 20, 19, it says, they were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jews. They did not know if they were next. And can you imagine some of the things that they may have said? What have we done with the last 3 years of our life? Was this just a madman? And we've lost our families and everything to follow this guy? Like, what is going on? God, where are you? We thought that this was our Messiah. We thought he was going to save us. We thought he was going to overthrow the government, that he was going to be king. And we don't know if we're going to survive or if we're next. So like David, they were hidden away in fear. And like David, they must have wondered, where is God in that moment? Maybe they were struggling with fears of abandonment. Maybe they thought that was it. God had left them high and dry. What I appreciate about David is his willingness to lament. This is not a skill that we have anymore. The lament, which is just cry out in honesty and authenticity and tell God where we're at, in all the ugliness, in all the mess, just laying it out. And in his Psalms, he doesn't hold back. How long will you forget me? Don't ignore my plea. Why are you standing so far off? Why have you forsaken me? Again, maybe we felt the same. Maybe we feel it now. Maybe we've felt it before. Maybe we're going to feel it again. Maybe we're wondering in this time of transition as our church is moving, like, God, where are you? We thought we did everything we were supposed to. We pray and we listened and we did. And it doesn't look the way we thought it was going to look. What's going on here? So what can we learn from these two stories about how to manage change? And what do we do in these times that maybe it feels like our connection to God has been disrupted? We're not really sure where he is, how he's working. And we have a hard time saying to ourselves, even when I don't see you, you're working, even when I don't feel you, you're working, because it just seems bleak. Well, first, be authentic. I think we romanticize the Psalms a little bit and think, oh, you know, their songs, their poetry, aren't they lovely? But feel like, my God, why have you forsaken me? Forsaken, that is a very strong word. Forsaken is like, you have left me. You have left me high and dry. If we're struggling, we can let God know. He's not that delicate. And he knows anyway. So, you know, if you tell him, it's not a surprise. But what it does for us is release. Do you remember The Green Mile, that movie? And remember The Green Mile? I just remember that kind of when he opened his mouth and spoke, there was like this, I don't know what they were. Whatever, flies or sparkles or whatever it was, it would dissipate. And that's what I feel like when we release the words into the universe, dissipate. It loses some of its power. So if we're feeling alone and abandoned and we hold on to that, it grows, it festers, it kind of takes root. But when we speak it out, it just kind of can dissipate. It can lose some of its power. So don't be afraid to tell God what's going on. David wasn't. And if you don't have the words, borrow David's. Second, look for your helpers. So Scott mentioned this last week. I was like, dude, you're taking my sermon here. I don't know if Scott is referencing this, but it for me, it comes from Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. You know I love Mr. Rogers. And he said that when he was growing up, when he would see things on TV or things that were very frightening, his mom would say to him, you know, kind of take your eyes off of the problem and look for the helpers. The helpers bring hope. So as we are moving through this time that's uncertain, that feels a little bit unsteady, look for your helpers. Who are your helpers? Look around the room. We have a whole community of helpers. We have leaders. We have other community members. So take advantage of that. Take advantage of accessing each other in your small group. Maybe, you know, around the dinner table when you're sharing a meal. Here in church, ask somebody to pray for you. For David, he had a lot of helpers. And if you read those Psalms, he felt very alone. But if we look at his story, he had Jonathan, who was Saul's son, who was his dearest friend. And Jonathan did help him out. He was like, I've got your back, and I'm going to send you messages about if things are safe or not safe. So Jonathan was there. Do you think their friendship was circumstance or by design? If I believe that God is who I think he is, it was probably by design. His wife, Michal. It says Michal loved David. It doesn't say David loved Michal, although I think he did. But Michal fell in love with David. And so then she got her dad to orchestrate it, and they got married. And through that relationship, Michal deceives Saul's men when they're coming to look for David, and it gives David enough time to escape. Circumstance or design? I vote design. And so as we're moving through this time, who are your helpers? Who has God brought into your life, your support network? Who can you reach out to if you're feeling like you don't have a support network? Really think that if you grabbed anyone in the church, most people would be like, absolutely, I will pray for you. I don't know your name, but let's do this thing. Because that's how we roll here, or how I hope we do. Third is hold our expectations loosely about how God's going to move. We had an expectation. Scott would be stepping out. Someone else would be stepping in. It'll happen. It's just not happening right now. So can we hold that loosely enough and just believe that God is in control? So David, again, depending on what that blessing was like, he may have had an idea of what his life was going to look like, the path it was going to take, the trajectory it was going to take. It did not turn out that way. He spent a lot of years running for his life. Can you imagine? Dirty, hungry, he's got this ragtag group of men. He's lost his wife. He's lost his best friend. And he was probably really tired. Tired of running. Tired of not having a home, a place to settle down, a place where he could just be in peace. And yet, what happens after Saul dies? He becomes king, and we'll talk about that next time. Even for the disciples that were waiting on God, they had this expectation, this belief that Jesus would be with them in his physical form, and he would lead them, and, you know, he would be the king. And then he's not there. He's gone. He shows up again resurrected, which must have freaked them out. And then he says, I'm going again, but I'm going to leave you. And depending on the translation you have, I'm going to leave you the counselor, the comforter, the advocate. I'm going to leave you a part of me, even though I'm not going to be here physically. And so imagine the paradigm shift those disciples had to make to then continue to partner with Jesus and move forward and spread the message. It's an uncertain time we're in, but we don't have to hide our feelings. We've got people to access. Let's hold things loosely and just wait. God does not leave us. It just often doesn't look the way we expect it to look. So look for those helpers. Now, we want to support you as a church. And so part of this idea of helpers is we want to open up the opportunity for people to come together at a time and a place if they need to process some of their feelings, if they've got some questions, if they want to talk about what's going on. Maybe some of you do, maybe nobody does. That's fine. We're just opening up the opportunity. If you feel like that would be helpful for you, then please talk to me or email transitionteam@cvcs.ca. Is that right, Jason? Or talk to Jason, or talk to Danielle, or talk to Laura, and we will make sure that we create space for us to come together and talk through and process and support as we kind of walk through this uncertainty. And as we wrap up this morning, I'm going to invite you guys to just get comfortable for a second. I would like to read you the entirety of Psalm 13. So close your eyes if you're comfortable, or just kind of rest your gaze somewhere. Open up your heart. And let's read Psalm 13. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, O Lord, my God, give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. My enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. I'll read those last couple of verses again. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord, for he has been good to me. If you're having trouble finding the words, let David's words beat for you. We're just going to sit here for a moment with these words. And like David said, let us sing God's praise and let him do his work.